Truth is said to be the first casualty of war, and the war in Iraq is no different. Most journalists either shelter inside the heavily fortified Baghdad Green Zone or find themselves embedded with U.S. forces on patrol. One of the few unembedded and independent journalists covering the situation in Iraq is the American Dar Jamal. Born and raised in Houston, Texas, Dar has been covering the war in Iraq for the past 18 months. He's currently on a speaking tour of North America before planning to return to Iraq in May. I managed to catch up with him in Vancouver on the eve of the second anniversary of the American invasion and subsequent occupation of Iraq.
Paul Jamieson, Information Clearinghouse out of California, just wondering if you had the opportunity to talk to anybody in the administration, who would it be and what would you want to tell them?
Oh, wow. That is a very good question. I would like to take all of them. I would like to take Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Connally's rising, Colin Powell. And I would like to take them into Fallujah and have them talk with families. And I would like to take them into Abu Ghraib and have them have to go through the process that Iraqis have to go through when they go to Abu Ghraib. I would like to have them go to the new graveyards in Fallujah and talk to families there of the civilians that have been killed. I would like to have them go to funerals of U.S. soldiers and have to talk to families of U.S. soldiers who've been killed and maimed in Iraq. And then I think I'd like to see them all tried for war crimes.
The U.S. mainstream media tells us that it's getting better and things are actually calming down. You've been there, I mean, mm-hmm. Is that...
The U.S. mainstream media in Iraq should leave their hotels.
Is there any chance that you would ever embed just to see it from the belly of the beast, to actually see the circus that goes on inside it?
I thought about it, but I'm actually blacklisted now by the military, so I couldn't embed even if I wanted to.
What happens when you go to checkpoints and things? Do they ever stop you and want to know where you're going?
No, they don't really know who I am unless you go and let them know, essentially. Yeah, I grow a beard and wear a keffiyeh and really try to fit in and stay low-key, and we go around in this junk car, and for the most part, you can be pretty incognito. The hardest part is just getting in, though, making it harder and harder for journalists to get in. You have to get a visa, and they're starting to get really particular. Even if you have full credentials, even journalists now are starting to get denied.
George Bush says America will only stay in Iraq as long as necessary and not a day longer. How long will it be for you, do you think?
For me reporting there, I take it a trip at a time. I definitely want to go back. I'll keep going back. I'm pretty committed to it. So even if when their adventures continue on into Iran or Syria, I'm gonna keep focusing on Iraq because they already have 4 permanent military bases there and 10 more in the works. So they're not leaving, and that's why they won't put a timetable out there.
When you come home and step off of the plane, and I mean, do you see a nation of sheep, people asleep, or what do you see? What do you feel? How do you process it?
Now I see a nation divided. I see the anti-war movement really gaining steam and people feeling more and more disenfranchised and angry and becoming more and more willing to do what's necessary to cause change and force the government to reflect their will. But I also see, of course, those who follow Bush is, they're sheep. They're ignorant, they're uninformed, but more and more I when I see that they don't have the time or maybe the resources even to really educate themselves and watch, read more media and watch different media, they're going on what they're told. And that's why I continue to really focus on the media situation and hold mainstream media accountable for inciting people to violence and not just misrepresenting the truth, but deliberately misleading and lying and omitting the truth from people.
Can you talk about the state of the free media in Baghdad? What is the media on the street?
That's a good question. let me give you a few examples of media. I mean, it's bad enough in the States, but in Iraq, well, we all know what's happened with Al Jazeera. I mean, they've been deliberately targeted from the very start. In the first week of the siege, November siege of Fallujah, the Iraqi government, i.e. the U.S. military, announced that any journalist not reporting the government side of the story would be detained. They also announced that, Alawi personally announced that any Al Jazeera journalist caught operating inside Iraq would be detained. We have situations where, you probably read, where there was a press conference a little bit before the elections. Alawi held a press conference, and any journalist that attended was handed $100 bills in envelopes. You know, just as like a, what's that? You know, so the buying off, the threats, the, you know, it's resembling, every passing day it's resembling the past regime as far as they tried to handle the information control and stuff. It's completely out of control.
How reliable would the reports by journalists reporting for people like Jihad Unspun, report certain battles of the Mujahideen against the US forces, and this happened and this happened, but I never hear anything about this in the Western media. I mean, is this spin on their part? I mean, is there spin on the other side too?
Or? There's definitely spin. In that website particularly, I've been asked that, and I think that they definitely... Yeah, the truth's somewhere in the middle with both. I mean, without a doubt, the Pentagon's lying every single day. But then also, these other numbers are definitely exaggerated. Mm. I mean, definitely not 30 U.S. troops a day are dying. But at the same time, I definitely, the U.S., by various methods, is underreporting their deaths and their casualties. And oftentimes, and I've reported on it personally, overestimating the number of fighters that they kill. I've seen that firsthand.
Right,
just
right.
They make it up. Sometimes just like 50, you know, being pulled out of thin air and manipulating the number at will. But both sides are exaggerating it, definitely. And the truth's really somewhere in the middle.
Excellent.
All right, thanks.
Have you ever been able to talk to any U.S. troops about what they're actually doing and their personal opinion of what they're doing on that?
Since I have an embedded, really the... You know, it's reading the body language and kind of talking with people. The longest conversations I've had with troops are like 30, 45 minutes, and they keep the stiff upper lip, and really their morale depends on how long they've been there. Like, the people that have been there a month or two, they're still like, yeah, you know, we believe in the mission, and I just want to get out of here in one piece, and I'm doing my job, I signed the dotted line, and then... on down to people that have been there 6 months, 9 months, or on their second tour. You know, I see people, you know, troops that are stoned, troops that are abusing people, you know, out in the open, like kicking people and aiming their guns and cussing at people, and they just don't care. And then treating journalists the same way. Some of them are really cool, and they're trying to, like, okay, accommodate you the best they can, and then other times they're grabbing your camera and throwing it on the ground or threatening you, you know, because they just don't care. You know, they've kind of already passed that point and slipped into that mindset, like Vietnam, they just don't give a damn. They've kind of lost, and they're there in this shit situation, and they're pissed, and there's nothing they can do, and the only sense, and, you know, and I don't, you know, I usually, when I have my longer presentations, I preface the whole Fallujah bit with that I don't try to demonize the truth, because at the end of the day, I hold responsible those who are given the orders and those who put them in this position, because most of them are good folks, and they're put in this horrible position via numerous circumstances, you know, the economy and things like this, and trying to support themselves and their families, and they're there, and at the end of the day, they're following orders, and yeah, there's some that are psycho, and they're getting off on killing people and doing these horrible things.
And we're definitely seeing the use of large-scale mass weapons, like flechettes, which I always thought were banned under the Geneva Convention. And
I don't think they are.
I know the Canadian military used to have them, and it was always really hush-hush. The Australian military used to have them, and it was something they had, but they never wanted to talk about, because it was... If it wasn't a banned weapon, it was a restricted weapon. I mean, it's a messy weapon. It's not a pinpoint sort of, let's take out that one guy. It's like, let's take out everybody on this block. And if you see those cameras of that crowd running down the street, they just all get taken out by something big. And you know, it's mad, it's crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's in it, again, it's like out of the grave. I mean, it's systemic, and if the orders are coming from the high up, they're coming from the top. It's like, you know, use the torture analogy. It's been happening from almost every detention facility in Iraq from the beginning of the occupation, and it's happening today.
Well, now it's up to, what, 108 confirmed dead?
Yeah.
From Bagram to Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib to...
a lot more than that, and it's the same with the war crimes, you know, when, you know, someone high up is giving these orders to use cluster bombs and flechettes and chemical weapons and phosphorus and uranium munitions on a daily basis. You know, the soldiers don't have the option of making these decisions. They're following orders, so, you know, go up the...
What do you think is the motivation for these orders? I mean, obviously, they can't be thinking that they're going to, by killing civilians, they're going to get ahead and use... Why do you think that's happening? I don't get that.
I think a lot of it, my opinion, a lot of it is I think it's the result. You know, every empire in history is always extremely racist. And I think a lot of it stems from that, viewing Iraqis as being subhuman and beneath them, and, you know, viewing them as all terrorists and, you know, all of this massive racism and discrimination. I think a lot of it's a result of that, in my opinion. And just these extremely heavy-handed tactics. Like, you know, Fallujah is the model. Like, anyone who dares stand in the way of U.S. imperialism, this is what you're going to get. And that's the model. And in a sense, in some ways, it's had its ramifications. I mean, it really shook a lot of people up and was a huge blow to the resistance in Iraq. But in the long run, it just creates more resistance, as we've seen.
If you were to come back here, like, a year today, like, where would you want to see it, and where do you fear you will see it?
Iraq.
Is the resistance growing? Is it getting tired? Is it going to shut down?
No, it's definitely growing. The armed resistance in Iraq, you mean? Yeah, it's definitely growing. Even Pentagon admits that it's 20,000 fighters, and a ways back it admitted that it had at least 200,000 sympathizers. And it's far more than that, because basically, you know, there's very, very few foreign fighters in Iraq, and there's very Saddam loyalists. I mean, 2 years into the occupation, these guys are pretty damn loyal. Right, I mean, it's that joke. Yeah, that's total propaganda. And the bottom line is, most of the people in the resistance, as most of the people in Fallujah, are people just fighting to defend their homes. They're fighting because if we're brothers and someone kills you, in tribal culture, I have to avenge your death. So if over 100,000 dead Iraqis, do the math, you know. And then, of course, the resistance with Paul Bremer creating it with disbanding the Iraqi army, one of the first things he did after promising them that he wouldn't do that.
I mean, do you think this is a deliberate sort of Straussian plan to, you know, a fire department that has no fires goes out of business, so let's start some fires and let them go, and then we'll always have fires to fight and we'll always be employed, and
it's very easy to argue that.
Military-industrial congressional complex gets to grow. And
yeah, I mean, without a resistance, and if everything's fine there, you can't legitimize keeping over 100,000 troops there.
With permanent bases.
With permanent bases.
Iran, maybe in June.
Right, right. And then we're seeing now, I mean, even today, reports are coming out that, you know, these plans were on the table long before 9/11. You know, so this is not news.
Wow.
Would you please comment on the Lebanon-Syria situation? What do you think?
Well, what I think is really interesting with it is that, again, it's a situation that's been taken totally out of, misrepresented and taken out of context by the mainstream, because if you remember history, and then B, if you just read it all, we see that Syria was allowed into Lebanon, given the green light by the U.S. in order to have them join the coalition of Bush 1 against Iraq in 1991. So in order to get them to gain the coalition, they greenlighted Syria, okay, you can have a free hand in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And then so now they're demanding that they leave when they shouldn't even have let them in the first place. And they could have done so years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the this car bombing, the assassination of Hariri, is very suspect. It was a bomb that went off. I mean, his convoys always have really the most sophisticated jamming equipment for these sorts of bombs. So what sort of bomb, what kind of technology is available and to whom to set this off? And the size of it. and the amount of planning that went into it is very suspect. And then the timing, and then how it was used and politicized by the Bush administration to use to be able to threaten Syria. And now another bombing today in Beirut, same thing, more saber rattling towards Syria. It's very suspect. And then again, how these demonstrations that followed were misrepresented. You know, that the anti-Syrian demonstrations being shown as if the whole country came out on the streets, and then the downgrading of the demonstrations that follow that were well over a million people. And then, of course, you know, and it goes on and on and on. It's just, again, just horrible misrepresentation. And people in America now think, oh, now we have democracy in Lebanon. Look at Bush, the savior of Lebanon. It's just, it's absolutely absurd. And then him saying, you know, using the excuse of, well, we can't have democratic elections in Lebanon if it's occupied. Okay.
American occupation.
Democratic occupation.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're here to help.